Hammer and his men had made better time than they'd figured, both the cold weather and fear spurring them on to push themselves as hard as possible. They stopped only once to build a small fire and fix a couple of pots of hot coffee to drink to help ward off the cold. Hammer wouldn't let them stop long enough to cook any food, and he didn't even let them rest to enjoy the coffee, but he made them put it in canteens to drink as they walked. They passed the Canadian border an hour or so after dawn, and they were within a mile of the outskirts of the town of Noyes. Hammer looked over his shoulder and saw four men on horseback bearing down on him in the distance, rifles in their hands. He glanced around and he saw a line of boulders over near a small draw that contained a tiny stream of water off to their right.
Spread out, man! Take cover in that draw over there!
The men dove over the banks of the stream and lined up with their rifles pointing toward the approaching men. Hammer and his men began to return fire, causing two of the men chasing them to rein in, jumping down off their mounts and taking cover behind some boulders in the open spaces near them. The other two split up, going in opposite directions as they rode in a flanking maneuver to either side of the outlaws.
Dang it, Bull! Take half the men and get them on the opposite side of the stream. They're coming around behind us.
The two men in front of the outlaws lay on their stomachs, firing over the rocks and not giving the gang a suitable target to shoot at as they rained shell after shell on the trapped men. Smoke and Lewis, after leaving Cal and Pearly to attack from the front, made their way around the outlaws' position to either side, staying just out of rifle range, riding bent low over their saddle horns. 20 minutes later, they were behind the gang, and they took positions on the ground in a small depression as they aimed and fired into the draw. Two of the outlaws collapsed under their fire. Smoke and Lewis began to find their range, the dead outlaws rolling down the sides of the draw and out of sight.
I wonder how many we'll have to kill before they decide it's time to give up.
It wouldn't bother me if they never gave up, and we killed all the pond scum. That'd save us the trouble of having to take them back to Winnipeg to stand trial before they're hung.
The shot came from behind him and Lewis, and Smoke turned to see five men riding out toward him from the town off in the distance. All of the men were holding rifles, and they were aimed straight at Smoke and Lewis.
Put down your weapons!
Smoke got to his feet and ran crouched over toward the horseman, noticing the man who'd shouted had a tin star on his chest. As Smoke got closer to him, the man lowered the barrel of his rifle until it pointed at Smoke's chest. Smoke lowered his rifle and held his hands out in plain sight away from his sides, but he didn't put the rifle down.
What the hell's going on here?
I'm Smoke Jensen, and my friends and I have tracked these men all the way from Canada. They held up a train there and killed almost 20 Pinkerton agents.
The sheriff's eyes narrowed as he stared over Smoke's shoulders at the men in the draw who quit firing at his arrival.
You got some papers saying you're a lawman or a warrant or wanted sheet on those men?
I'm not a lawman. I was hired by the railroad to bring these men in.
Well, we'll see about that. I'm Sheriff Luke McCain, and Noyes here is my town. Tell your friends to cease firing and throw down their weapons, Mr. Jensen.
Smoke looked back over his shoulder at the outlaws.
What about them? When we throw down our guns, what's to keep them from rushing us?
I'll take care of them. You just do what I say. I'm gonna ride up there and take those men in the draw into custody.
The sheriff spurred his horse forward until he got to the draw where the outlaws were still lying in cover.
Keep your mouth shut and do what I say, and maybe we'll all get out of this alive. You and your men put down your guns and pretend you don't know me. I'm gonna have to arrest you and take you to jail.
What? Why don't you just shoot hell out of these hombres and let us get on our way?
Don't be a damned fool, Hammer. There are too many witnesses around. Those deputies of mine aren't in on this with us. Just do what I say. And don't worry, I've got the judge in my pocket. But we'll have to play this out like it's real.
You wouldn't be trying to fool me, would you, Luke?
Not a chance, Hammer. You got too much on me for me to try that. Now do what I say and everything will be all right. As long as you and your men keep your heads.
All right, Luke. But if you try to double-cross me, you'll live to regret it.
Hey, pal, if you want, I can just leave you and your men here and let those fellas behind me pick you off one by one. How would that be? Then I wouldn't have to put my ass on the line trying to save yours.
Hammer glanced over Luke's shoulder at Smoke and Lewis, standing near Luke's deputies 100 yards away.
No. All in all, I think I'd rather go with you and your men.
Then shut the hell up, and put your weapons down and climb out of that draw.
Luke turned his back on Hammer and walked his mount away.
All right, men. Drop your guns and come with me. Keep your mouth shut and let me do all the talking. We'll all end up swinging from a rope.
But boss, he said he was gonna put us in jail.
Bull, you say one more word and you won't go to jail, cause I'll kill you where you stand.
An hour and a half later, with all the Hammer's men crowded into the small jail cells and noise, Sheriff Luke McCain had a meeting with Smoke and his men and Hammer in his office. Luke sat canted back in his swivel chair behind his desk. Hammer and Smoke sat in straight-back chairs in front of the desk. Lewis and Cal and Pearly stood nearby, with two of Luke's deputies keeping watch on them. All of their guns had been confiscated on Luke's orders, until he could get the story straight.
Now, Mr. Jensen, tell me your side of the story.
This bastard and his men robbed a payroll train near Winnipeg, Canada yesterday. In so doing, they killed or severely injured over 25 Pinkerton agents who'd been hired as security on the train. My men and I were hired by William Cornelius Van Horn to track them down and bring them to justice.
Mr. Hamrick, what have you got to say for yourself?
Me and my men don't know nothing about no train robbery. Well, we were up in Canada mining for gold, and once we cashed out our ore, we were on our way back here when this man and his friends ambushed us. They killed 8 of my friends in Canada last night and ran off all our horses. So we began walking as fast as we could trying to get back here to Minnesota, where we hoped to find some lawman to protect us from these killers. And then they attacked us again right outside your town and killed 2 more of my men while we were just trying to hide from them. Personally, I think you should arrest Jensen and his men for murder instead of bothering us innocent miners who ain't done nothing wrong.
What about the money you found on them?
Yes, what about the money, Mr. Hamrick?
I told you, we sold our ore, and that's the money we got for it. Well, it's my guess these men found out about it and was trying to rob us of it when we managed to sneak off in the middle of the night and escape from them.
I'm told there's $50,000 in that sack, and all of it in new bills. Are you trying to get us to believe you were paid in brand new currency for your gold?
That's what the assayer's office gave us. I don't know anything about where he got it from or if it's new bills or old. All me and my men cared about was getting paid for our ore and heading back down south to get away from the cold up there.
Smoke got to his feet, went over to the bag, pulled out several stacks of bills.
And these burn marks on some of the bills? How do you explain that?
That happened when you and your men blew up my camp with dynamite. We were lucky to save the money from the fire you started. You can backtrack us to our camp, Sheriff, and you'll see I'm telling the truth. There's plenty of evidence of the dynamite explosion there, along with 8 dead men these men killed last night.
He's lying through his teeth, Sheriff. If you'll wire Winnipeg, you'll get the straight story from Mr. Van Horn.
What'll that prove, Sheriff? I don't know, but maybe these men here were hired to find the train robbers, and maybe they just made an honest mistake and attacked my men and me, thinking we were the robbers. But why didn't you ask Mr. Jensen here if he or his men actually saw us rob this train? Or if he's just guessing about who did it?
What about that, Mr. Jensen? Did you see this man or any of his companions rob the train?
No, sir, we didn't.
There, you see, Sheriff, he has no proof that me and my men were even involved in a train robbery.
Oh, I wouldn't say that, Mr. Hamrick. There was a witness. A man you wounded but left alive who will testify that he knows you and recognized you at the robbery site.
There couldn't be. We wore...
You were about to say you wore a mask, weren't you, Hamrick? Well, the fact is you did wear a mask. But the lead Pinkerton detective, Albert Knowles, recognized your voice and your clothes from a conversation you had with him the day before the robbery. And he's willing to testify to that in court.
Well, that changes things, Mr. Hamrick. I find Mr. Jensen's story to have enough substance to hold you and your men here until I can check out the facts for myself.
How about you just put them in our custody and let us take them back to Winnipeg to stand trial?
No, I can't do that, Mr. Jensen. First, I'll have to wire this Van Horn fella. And then, if he backs your story, we'll have to go before Judge Harlan Fitzpatrick here in Noyes to see if Mr. Hamrick and his men will be tried here or in Canada.
But that could take days, and my men and I have to be back in Winnipeg as soon as possible.
Well, you're welcome to leave, Mr. Jensen. And if the judge says they can be sent back to Canada to stand trial, I'm sure the Canadian government can send some lawmen down here to collect him.
Smoke looked over his shoulder at Lewis, who just shrugged.
It won't hurt to give him a couple of days. I know I can use the rest.
All right. We'll get some rooms in a hotel and wait for you to contact Mr. Van Horn, and then we'll see what happens. Don't get your hopes up, killer. I promised Mr. Van Horn I'd see you dead or in jail. And if truth be told, I'd just as soon it be dead.
Smoke paused and stared into the sheriff's eyes.
And that goes for anyone who stands in my way, too.
Are you threatening me, Mr. Jensen?
No, sir. Not if you're just doing your job. But something smells funny here, and it's not just these men.
Smoke and his friends left the sheriff's office and took their horses to the livery stable, where they arranged for him to be fed and curried and taken care of for a few days. As they left the livery, Lewis had a thoughtful expression on his face, and Smoke noticed him glancing toward the sheriff's office as they walked down the street toward the town's only hotel.
What's on your mind, Lewis?
I was just thinking how strange our conversation with the sheriff was. He seemed to be leaning over backwards to take Hamrick's side in all this.
Smoke realized Lewis had the same doubts he did. Both of their instincts were trying to tell him something, and Smoke had found over the years that he should trust his instincts. Sheriff McCain had acted a little strange in their meeting, but in the beginning, Smoke had just put it down to the fact that they were all strangers to the sheriff, nothing more. Now that he found Lewis had the same suspicions, he wasn't so sure that was all it was.
You may be right, Lewis, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see what the judge says after they've contacted Bill and he verifies our story.
When you men get through talking about how strange the sheriff was, you think we could find some place to eat? My stomach's done shrunk up to the size of a walnut. It's been so long since it's been fed.
Sure, Pearlie. We wouldn't want you fainting from hunger out here in the middle of Main Street, now would we?
Hell, Smoke, if and I did faint, I'd probably drown in this here mud.
They stopped at a small restaurant with Ma's Diner over the door and went in to take a table in the corner so Smoke could watch the door, as was his habit.
Three things I've learned over my many years out west.
What's that, Lewis?
One, never get in a shooting match with Smoke Jensen. Two, never play cards with a man who uses the name of a city as his first name. And three, never eat in a place called Mars.
After their meal, which even Lewis had to admit was quite good, though he put it down to the fact that they were all about half starved to death, they walked down the street to a small two-story hotel named Winston's. Smoke took three rooms on the second floor, facing the street. That was another precaution he'd learned over the years. The second floor made it harder for someone to sneak up on him or fire through an open window, and the windows facing the street let him monitor what was going on in town without exposing him to gunfire from an adversary. Over at the jail, McCain held up his hand when Hammer argued about having to spend the night locked up with his men.
Now hold on, Hammer. First off, I don't want Jensen getting suspicious about us having an arrangement. I don't want him trying to telegraph any U.S. Marshals until after we've seen the judge and gotten things fixed up.
Hammer sullenly agreed McCain was probably right, though he did insist on the sheriff leaving the cell door unlocked and their guns out where they could get to him if Jensen or his men tried anything during the night. McCain told him not to worry about that, and he was going to have a deputy keep watch on Jensen's hotel rooms all through the night.
Now, I'm going to take $5,000 of your money and pay a little visit to Judge Fitzpatrick over at the courthouse.
$5,000? Ugh! Hell, back where I come from, you could buy an entire town for that much money.
Listen, Hammer, You and your men did kill over 20 Pinkerton agents in cold blood. That's a lot for a judge to overlook, even one whose nose is always in a bottle. He and I are both going to catch a lot of heat on this when you and your men end up walking out of here free and clear. I'm sure he won't think it's too much money when the federal marshals and the circuit court judge ream his ass out for finding for you in the upcoming trial. So pay him the money and keep your mouth shut.
You haven't said what your share's gonna be yet.
I think 5 will do me nicely. And at that, you're getting a bargain.
But that only leaves me and my men with a little over $2,000 each. And we did all the work.
Yeah, well, I could always let Jensen and his men have another go at you. If he managed to kill most of your men, your share'd be even bigger, Hammer. Is that what you want?
Hammer looked down at his feet and shook his head.
And don't forget, it was you and your men who killed a lot of Pinkertons and then managed to let yourself be followed to my town. Just be glad you'll be walking out of here and able to rob another train, rather than taking a short trip on a rope followed by a long dirt nap.
All right. All right.
The next morning, after McCain had visited Judge Fitzpatrick at his home the previous night, given him more money than he could make in 2 years on the bench, the sheriff summoned Smoke and his friends from the hotel. He walked with them over to the county courthouse, and he ushered them into Judge Harlan Fitzpatrick's courtroom at precisely 9 o'clock in the morning. Of the outlaws, only Hamrick was present in the courtroom when they entered. He was being watched over by one of the deputies from the day before. After a moment, the judge entered from his chambers and proceeded to take his seat behind a high desk in front of the room.
This court will come to order.
Fitzpatrick dropped his eyes to a sheet of paper in front of him, and he studied it. After a moment, he looked up over the half-glasses perched on the end of his bulbous, vein-lined nose.
The sheriff has provided me with a telegram from a Mr. William Cornelius Van Horn, who is in charge of the Canadian Pacific Railroad. This telegram does say there was a train robbery in which many Pinkerton agents were killed, and that you...
He cut his eyes to Smoke.
Mr. Jensen, and your companions were hired to apprehend the perpetrators of said robbery. However, the telegram does not state the name of any of the robbers, and the description given of the leader of said band of thieves could fit most any man here.
Your Honor.
Yes, Mr. Jensen? You have a statement you'd like to make to the court?
Yes, sir. Mr. Van Horn's message doesn't give a name because until we caught up with the robbers, we didn't know any of their names. However, there is a Pinkerton agent who can make a full identification of Mr. Hamrick here as the leader of the outlaws.
And is this witness here in the court ready to make such an identification? If he is, let him come forward and be heard.
No, Your Honor. The Pinkerton agent, Mr. Albert Knowles, was rather severely injured in the attack on the train and will not be able to travel for several weeks at least.
The judge pursed his lips and pretended to contemplate this turn of events.
And you yourself and your companions were not witnesses to this alleged train robbery, and therefore cannot say with absolute certainty that Mr. Hamrick and his associates were the men who committed this dastardly crime?
No, Your Honor.
Well, then, in that case, I see no alternative but to postpone this hearing until such time as this Mr. Knowles can be brought down here to make his identification. I will reset the preliminary hearing for 1 month from today, at which time the circuit court judge and any necessary federal marshals can be present for the hearing.
But, Your Honor...
The court has ruled.
The judge glared at Smoke, and then suddenly his face paled and his eyes changed as if he was seeing Smoke for the first time. He shook his head, got ponderously to his feet, and gathered his robes around him. He disappeared through the door to his chambers with as much dignity as a man half inebriated could manage. The sheriff looked over at Smoke and shrugged his shoulders as he got to his feet and approached him.
I'm sorry about that, Jensen. I'll try to keep Hamrick and his men locked up until you can get your witness here, but I don't know if the judge will allow it. He may release him on bail until the time of the trial.
Smoke just shook his head, his eyes boring into McCain.
Well, we can't wait around here for a month.
So, I guess we'll head back to Canada and see what we can do about getting Mr. Knowles back here in time for the trial.
I think that'd be best, Jensen. And I'll make sure that Hamrick and his men aren't released until you've left town, just so there won't be any, altercations or disagreements.
But you will make sure they stay here in town until we get back, won't you, Sheriff?
Oh, I'm sure Judge Fitzpatrick will set bail high enough to ensure they show up for the trial.
I hope so, Sheriff. Because as soon as we get back to Winnipeg, I'm going to make sure the governor of Minnesota, as well as the U.S. Marshal's office, is notified of what happened here today.
That's certainly you're right, Mr. Jensen.
And we'll also make sure the Pinkertons know where to find the men who killed so many of their agents. And I'll tell you one thing, Sheriff McCain. I sure as hell wouldn't want to have the entire Pinkerton organization mad at me. Those boys are known to play rough, if you get my meaning.
McCain looked nervously over his shoulder at Hamrick, and then he nodded his head.
I certainly do get your meaning, Mr. Longmont, and I'll be sure to pass it along to the judge just as soon as I can.
Be sure that you do, Sheriff, because if something happens and those men aren't here to stand trial next month, I wouldn't give even odds on a bet that you or the judge live to see the summer. No threat, Sheriff. Just stating the plain facts.
After Smoke and his men left their hotel and went to the livery to get their horses, Sheriff McCain followed them at a distance to make sure they left town and to make sure they didn't stop at the telegraph office to send any telegrams to the U.S. Marshal's office. Once he was sure they were on their way, he stopped back by the jail and picked up Hammer, and they headed for the judge's chambers to thank him for what he'd done in court. When they entered, they found Judge Fitzpatrick leaning back in his chair, sipping from a glass of amber liquid, an almost empty bottle of bourbon on the desk in front of him. The judge's eyes were unfocused, and his thoughts seemed to be 1,000 miles away. In spite of the fact that the judge was clearly well on the way to being drunk, he had a worried look on his face, and a small sheen of sweat covered his brow in spite of the coolness of the room.
Hey, Judge, why the frown? Everything went just as we'd planned it, and Jensen and his men have already left town.
Fitzpatrick turned bloodshot, bleary eyes on the two men sitting in front of him.
Dear Luke, you have no idea what you've done, do you, dear boy?
What do you mean, Judge?
Why didn't you tell me one of the men we were going up against was Smoke Jensen?
I didn't think it mattered who it was, as long as you made sure the letter of the law was on our side. And I did tell you one of the men's name was Jensen, don't you remember?
Yes, but you didn't say his first name was Smoke.
What does that matter? And just who is this Smoke Jensen anyway that he's got you so spooked?
Let me tell you men a story, and then maybe you'll understand why I'm not jumping with joy about the fact that I took $5,000 to portray my robes. In fact, I doubt very seriously if I live long enough to spend a tenth of it.
McCain looked at Hammer and shrugged, wondering what was going on.
Well, what are you talking about, Judge Fitzpatrick? This Jensen fella's just another of those old coots they call mountain men that like to live up in the mountains and kill beaver and such for a living.
You couldn't be more wrong, Mr. Hammerick.
The judge leaned back and held his glass with both hands, resting it on his paunch as he slowly rocked in his swivel chair.
Now, as I said, let me tell you a story, and then maybe you'll understand. Many years ago, I was just out of law school, and my first job was working in a small town in Idaho named Rico. Now, it was mainly a mining camp, and I kept myself busy filing claims for miners and settling disputes over who filed first and elementary things like that. Then one day, two men drifted into town, one older and the other barely out of his teens. Their names were Preacher and Smoke Jensen. Now, I was in a bar, just making conversation, and asked them why they'd come to Rico, since they didn't look like miners. The young one, Smoke, said they were looking for the men who'd killed and robbed his brother, and then killed his father when he went looking for them. Well, I didn't have much to say to that, since at that time Rico was plumb full of outlaws and brigands, and the old man named Preacher asked me where the nearest general store was. I told him we didn't have a store, but there was a trading post down the street a ways, and that I'd be glad to point it out to him. And after a while, we finished our drinks, and He and the young fella got on their horses and rode down the street, me walking alongside to show him the way. And when we got there, I pointed the place out to him, stopped to build myself a cigarette, and the damnedest thing happened.
Smoking Preacher dismounted in front of the Trading Post saloon. As was his custom, Kirby slipped the thongs from the hammers of his colts at dismounting. They bought their supplies and were about to leave when two rough-dressed and unshaven men, both wearing guns, walked in and blocked the door.
Who owns that horse out there? The one with an SJ brand.
Kirby laid his purchases on the counter.
I do.
Which way'd you ride in from?
Preacher had slipped to the right, his left hand covering the hammer of his Henry, concealing the click as he thumbed it back. Kirby faced the man, his right hand hanging loose by his side. His left hand was just inches from his left-hand gun.
Who wants to know and why?
Pike's my name, and I say you come through my diggings yesterday and stole my dust.
And I say you're a liar.
Why, you little pup, I'll shoot your ears off.
Why don't you try? I'm tired of hearing you shoot your mouth off.
I think I'll just kill you for that.
Pike and his partner reached for their guns. Pike, with two holes in his chest, died with his back to a support pole, his eyes still open, unbelieving. Neither had managed to pull a pistol more than halfway out of leather.
Good God! I never even seen the draw!
Preacher had the muzzle of his Henry to cover the men at the tables. The bartender put his hand slowly on the bar, indicating that he wanted no trouble.
We'll be leaving now.
Kirby holstered his Colts and picked up his purchases from the counter. He walked out the door.
What are we supposed to do with the bodies?
Bury them.
What's that kid's name?
Smoke.
The judge let his eyes settle on Hamrick for a moment.
Anyway, that was the first time I met the man named Smoke Jensen. A few days later, I went to visit a friend in a nearby town, and I heard how everyone was talking about how a friend of Preacher's told Smoke that two men, Haywood and Thompson, who claimed to be Pike's brother, had tracked him and Preacher and were in town, waiting for Smoke to show up.
Thompson and Haywood were in the big tent at the end of the street, which served as saloon and cafe. Preacher had pointed him out earlier and asked if Smoke needed his help. Smoke said no. The refusal came as no surprise. As he walked down the street, a man glanced up and spotted him, then hurried quickly inside. Smoke felt no animosity toward the men in the tent saloon, no anger, no hatred. But they came here after him, so let the dance begin. The word had swept through the makeshift town, and from behind cabin walls, trees, and boulders, the people watched as Smoke stopped about 50 feet from the tent.
Haywood! Thompson! You want to see me? Then step out and see me.
The two men pushed back the tent flap and stepped out, both of them angling to get a better look at the man they had tracked.
You the kid called Smoke?
I am.
With instinct born into a natural fighter, Smoke knew this would be no contest. Both men carried their guns tucked behind wide leather belts, an awkward position from which to draw, for one must first pull the hand up, then over, grabbing the pistol, cocking it as it's pulled from behind the belt, then leveling it to fire. It's also a dandy way to shoot oneself in the belly or side.
Pike was my brother.
And Shorty was my pal.
You should choose your friends more carefully.
They was just funning with you.
You weren't there. You don't know what happened.
You calling me a liar?
If that's the way you want to take it.
Thompson's hand moved closer to the .44 in his belt.
Take that back or make your play.
There's no need for this.
You're a damn thief. You stole their gold and then killed them.
Smoke, who had spent hundreds of hours practicing his deadly skills, thought that they were doing everything wrong. These men weren't gun hands. He could smell the fear sweat from the men.
I don't want to have to kill you.
That's because you're yellow.
Haywood grabbed for his gun.
Haywood! You bastard, you shot my gun!
Haywood dropped to the dirt, dying. As the angel of death began to enfold him in her cold, dark embrace, he had a vision of Thompson spinning in the street. Then he died. Thompson was on one knee, his left hand holding his shattered right elbow. His leg was bloody. Smokin' knocked his gun from his hand, then shot him in the leg on the way down.
Pike was your brother, so I understand why you came after me. But you were wrong. I'll let you live, but stay with mining. If I ever see you again, I'll kill you.
The young man turned, putting his back to the dead and bloody. He walked slowly up the street, his high-heeled Spanish riding boots pocking the air with dusty puddles. The judge paused in his story.
You mind if I have a shot of that whiskey, Judge?
No, not at all, Mr. Hammerick. How about you, Luke? You want a taste, too?
Luke didn't answer, but just reached out and poured him and Hammer drinks, emptying the bottle.
Not to worry, there's plenty more where that came from.
The judge got another bottle out of his desk drawer and placed it on the desk between them.
I have a feeling we're all gonna need another one soon.
Anyway, after Smoke shot and killed Pike, his friend and Haywood and wounded Pike's brother, Thompson, he and Preacher went after the other men who had killed Smoke's brother and stolen the Confederates' gold. They rode on over to La Plaza de los Leones, the Plaza of the Lions. It was there that they trapped a man named Casey in a lion shack with some of his friends. Now, the way I hear it, Smoke and Preacher burned them out and captured Casey. Smoke took him to the outskirts of the town and hung him on a telegraph pole for the entire town to see.
He just hung him? No trial or anything?
Yes, Luke. But you've got to realize that's the way it was done in those days. That town would never hang one of their own on the word of Smoke Jensen. Like as not, they'd have hanged Smoke and Preacher instead. Anyway, after that, the sheriff of that town put out a flyer on Smoke, accusing him of murder. Had a $10,000 reward on it, too.
Did Smoke and Preacher go into hiding?
With a $10,000 reward on his head? He must have, because most men had turned in their mother for that kind of money.
No, sir, he didn't. Seems Preacher advised it, but Smoke said he had one more call to make. I didn't see this, you understand, but a man who was there told me all about it shortly after it happened. They rode on over to Oreodelphia, looking for a man named Ackerman. But, and this is the funny part, they didn't go after him right at first. Smoke and Preacher sat around doing nothing for 2 or 3 days. You see, gentlemen, Smoke was smart, as well as fast with his guns. He wanted Ackerman to get plenty nervous. He did. And finally came gunning for Smoke with a bunch of men who rode for his brand.
At the edge of town, Ackerman, one bull of a man with small, mean eyes and a cruel slit for a mouth, slowed his horse to a walk. Ackerman and his hands rode down the street, 6 abreast. Preacher and Smoke were on their feet. Both men slipped the thongs from the hammers of the Colts. Preacher wore 2 Colts, 44s. One in a holster, the other stuck behind his belt. Mountain man and young gunfighter stood 6 feet apart on the boardwalk. Ackerman and his men wheeled their horses to face the men on the boardwalk.
I hear tell you boys is looking for me. If so, here I am.
News to me. What's your name?
You know who I am, kid. Ackerman.
Oh, yeah. You're the man who helped kill my brother by shooting him in the back. Then you stole the gold he was guarding.
You're a liar. I didn't shoot your brother. That was Potter and his bunch.
You stood and watched it, then you stole the gold.
It was war, kid.
But you were on the same side. So that not only makes you a killer, it makes you a traitor and a coward.
I'll kill you for saying that.
You'll burn in hell long time before I'm dead.
Smoke took the men on the left, Preacher the men on the right side. Battle lasted no more than 10 to 12 seconds. When the smoke and the noise had cleared, 5 men lay in the street, 2 of them dead. 2 more would die from their wounds. 1 was shot in the side. He would live. Ackerman had been shot 3 times, once in the belly, once in the chest, and 1 ball had taken him in the side of the face. His corpse still sat in his saddle. The big man finally leaned to one side and toppled from his horse. 1 boot hung in the stirrup. The horse shied, then began walking down the dusty street, dragging Ackerman, leaving a bloody trail. The judge finished his story and drained his glass, his face pale at the memory of such a dangerous young man. Hammer drained his drink and glanced over at Luke McCain, who had a thoughtful look on his face.
So, Judge, I appreciate your story about this Smoke Jensen and what a tough hombre he was. But what was your point in telling us all this?
Do you know how old Jensen was when all this happened?
Luke and Hammer both shook their heads.
He was only 18 years old. And I remember thinking to myself, I'd never seen eyes so cold except on a diamondback rattlesnake.
Luke and Hammer remained silent, their eyes fixed on the judge.
And my point in telling you this, Mr. Hammerick, was to let you know that you've got us all in a hell of a mess.
Why didn't you say something when I came to you and we made our plans on how to handle this?
I'd forgotten all about it. After all, that was over 30 years ago, and Jensen is a rather common name.
So how do you know this Jensen's the same one in your story?
I said Jensen is a common name, Mr. Hammerick, but Smoke is definitely not. But it really only came back to me when Jensen stared at me at the end of the trial and said he'd be back. When I looked into those eyes as black as obsidian, I knew I was looking at death incarnate.
I think you're overreacting, Judge.
No, Hammer. The story I told you illustrates that Smoke Jensen is a man who neither forgets nor forgives. When he finds out that you and your men were set free and that Luke and I were in this with you, he will come after all of us, and God help us. He'll kill us all as sure as the winter up here brings snow.
Well, maybe we'll get him first when he comes.
If you think any of us has the slightest chance against such a man when he's on the prod for us, then you are sadly mistaken, my boy. But even if by chance you or Luke get lucky and do finish him before he kills all of us, by then it won't matter. Jensen will have already contacted the governor and the U.S. Marshals. So even if by some fluke of luck you do survive his attack, there will be a price on all of our heads that will make us a target for every bounty hunter in these territories.
So what do you propose?
Your only chance, and Luke's and my only chance, is if you and your men go after Smoke Jensen and kill him and his companions before they find out you've been released and he has cause to contact the governor and the marshals. Then, and only then, will we be safe.
But, Judge, you just said we wouldn't stand a chance against Jensen. So why are you recommending we go looking for him?
I said you could not defeat him once he's on your trail and looking for you, Luke. I think the only chance anyone has of killing Smoke Jensen is if he doesn't know they're after him. If he's not expecting an attack, perhaps he can be ambushed and killed before he's on his guard.
But, Judge, Jensen and his men are going up into the Canadian wilderness to survey for the railroad. There's no telling where they'll be, or even if me and my men can find them.
Yes, there is a way, Mr. Hammerick. When you survey for a railroad, you leave trail marks to show the men coming behind you where to lay the tracks. Yeah, Jensen and his men will be leaving a trail even a child could follow. All you and your men will have to do is stay clear of the railroad authorities so you won't be identified before you can find and eliminate Jensen and his men.
Yeah. While we're up there, I'll make sure to take care of that Knowles fella who's the only witness to my being at that robbery site.
Good thinking. If there are no witnesses against you, then Luke and I will not have to explain why we let you out of jail.
If I hurry, maybe my men and I can catch up to them before they get back to Winnipeg.
No. Give them a good lead. It'll be much better if they're killed in the Canadian wilderness rather than on the trail back to Winnipeg. That way, if you're careful, you can blame it on the Indians or some other brigands up there, and no suspicion will fall on you.
Also, you need to take care of this Knowles man first, so that if Jensen does call the governor, he won't have a witness who can testify against you.
So I take it you're not planning on coming up with us to Canada?
No. Inasmuch as you got yourself and the judge and me into this mess, I think it's only right you should get us out of it on your own.
Well, that'll be my pleasure.
The judge smiled, and he reached over to pour them all fresh drinks.
In that case, I think we should drink to a successful conclusion to all our troubles.
Smoke and his friends took their time riding back to Winnipeg. They were still tired after the long, hard ride to catch up with Hammer and his men, and they decided an extra day or two on the journey back wouldn't make any difference to Van Horn. When they finally arrived in Winnipeg, they went immediately to see Van Horn, only to find he'd already left town. He was pushing his track-laying laborers harder than he ever had, and according to the men still in Winnipeg, he was managing to stay only a few miles behind the surveyors as they blazed a trail through very heavily wooded countryside.
How far out of town has he managed to lay the tracks?
Close to 20 miles already.
20 miles? That'll take us several days to catch up with them on horseback.
Oh, Mr. Jensen, there's no need for you to try and follow him on horseback. With the tracks laid, we can send you by train with no problem. Hell, we'll have to go back and forth almost every day with supplies for the laborers anyway.
But what about our horses and equipment? We're gonna need them when we catch up with Wilson and his crew.
Well, that's no problem either, my friends. We'll just attach an extra boxcar to the train and your animals and supplies will be carried along with you. When you reach the end of the track, you can talk with Mr. Van Horn and then be on your way to join up with Tom Wilson and the other surveyors up ahead.
When's the train leaving?
Yeah, and do we have time to eat first?
Sure. I'll tell the cook to fix you up something right away, and by the time you're done eating, the train will be loaded up and ready to go.
Your boy is going over to the cook tent. I'm going to drop by the hospital tent and see how Albert Knowles is doing, and let him know what happened to Noyes.
Lewis and the boys headed for the cook tent, while Smoke made his way over to the tent where injured workers were kept until they healed enough to be put back on the line. Knowles had elected to stay there rather than in town so he could better supervise his few remaining men in the guard duties and to be on site when the replacement agents he'd sent for arrived in Winnipeg. Smoke pulled back the tent flaps and walked down the aisle between the rows of beds, amazed at how many men were in the tent recovering from injuries suffered while laying track or blasting rock from the rail bed.
This must be a hard life for these men, and they sure as hell don't get paid enough for the dangers they face every day.
When he got to the end of the aisle, he saw Albert Knowles, his broken left leg propped up on a wooden device that kept it elevated so the swelling would stay down while he healed. Most of his burns were scabbed over, and Smoke was glad to see there was no sign of infection, which killed most men with bad burns.
Hey, Albert.
Why, Smoke? When did you get back?
Just a little while ago.
Did you catch those sons of bitches that killed my men?
Yes. We had to kill a few, but the rest are in custody in Noyes, Minnesota.
Noyes? Why the hell did they head down that way?
I don't really know. Unless they were trying to get across the border, thinking we wouldn't be able to go after them there.
But you fooled them, huh?
Yeah. Anyway, the sheriff and judge down there promised to hold them for at least a month. Until you're well enough to go down there and make a positive identification of the leader, a man named Hamrick.
So that's the bastard's name, huh?
Yes, and he's as hard a case as I've ever come across. It won't be any loss when you identify him, and he and his men are hanged.
Good. The doc says another 2 or 3 weeks and I'll be able to travel. I'll see if Van Horn will arrange for me to go part of the way down there by train, so I should be able to be there within a month if there are no complications.
Well, I'll be seeing you, Albert. Take care of yourself, and let me know what happens at the trial.
I will, Smoke, and thanks for what you did for my men and me.
Think nothing of it. Those men deserve what they're going to get. I just wish I could be there to see it happen when they hit the end of their ropes.
Smoke turned and went to the cook tent, hoping he'd have time to eat before the train got ready. And as it turned out, Smoke had just finished his meal when the station man came into the cook tent, told him the train was loaded and ready to leave. Just as he'd promised, their horses and supplies were loaded in a boxcar that had been added to the train. As they boarded the short train, Pearlie looked at the almost empty passenger car.
Good, there's plenty of empty seats. Think I'll take me a short nap to help me digest my food.
When did you ever need any help digesting your food, Pearlie?
Well, I don't know if we can get steaks as thick and as good as the railroad cook fixed us. Especially if you're doing the cooking, Cal.
Huh? I never heard you complain when I cooked. You always had your mouth too full to even speak, let alone complain.
That's because the belly aches always came later, when you weren't around.
A nap sounds good to me, too.
Yeah, it might be good if we all got some sleep. I have a feeling once we join up with Tom Wilson and the Mountain Men, we're going to be working from daylight to dark most every day.
That's right. The country we're going to be surveying is among the wildest in North America, from what I heard around the rail yard.
It's hard to believe it's any wilder than the High Lonesome north of Colorado.
Well, the country's about the same. But since the Rocky Mountains in Canada are so much farther north, the weather is even worse than in Colorado.
I find that hard to imagine.
As the train pulled out of the station on its 2 or 3 hour journey, four men stretched out on seats in the car, pulled their hats down over their eyes, dropped off to sleep before the train got up to full speed. The men were so tired they had to be woken up when the train finally reached the end of the tracks. Van Horn himself performed the task, standing in front of the car and banging a knife against the side of a bottle of fine brandy. When the bell-like tones brought the men to their feet, he had a Chinese boy pour generous drinks into brandy snifters for them all. Then he sat among them, demanding to be told in detail of their exploits on the trail of the train robbers. Smoke left the telling of the tale to Lewis, who was much the better speaker, and he had Van Horn in stitches laughing at how Smoke had blown up the outlaw supplies and then killed them by dropping shotgun shells into their campfire. His expression sobered when he heard how the sheriff and judge had acted as if Smoke and the rest of them were the criminals instead of the outlaws.
Those dumb sons of bitches! Just wait until I get back to camp. I'm going to wire the governor of Minnesota, who, by the way, is a personal friend of mine, as well as the United States Marshal's office in Grand Forks, and see if I can't light a fire under those boys. They'll be sorry they ever messed with William Cornelius Van Horn before I'm done with them.
Bill tried to fill Smoke's glass a second time.
Whoa there, partner. You keep that up, and we won't be able to sit a saddle when we head on up ahead to join Tom Wilson and his crew.
Nonsense. You'll spend the night here with me, of course. I've got my private rail car at the head of the tracks. You boys have been on the trail almost continuously. It's time you had a good night's sleep and some decent food.
Did you say food?
Yes, Spurly. In addition to bringing my private car with me whenever I'm out laying track, I also bring my own private chef along as well.
Well, as you can well see, I believe in living as well as one can, no matter the circumstances or the geography.
How about them copper bathtubs? Some of us could use a bath and another go-around with that brush and soap we used on the way up here.
Yes, I think hot baths and a good shave will make you all feel better, as well as making those who sit near you more comfortable as well.
When they got out of the passenger car and walked up the tracks toward Van Horn's private cars, Smoke was amazed at the number of men he saw working alongside the tracks up ahead. He figured there must have been several thousand men stretched for almost a mile on either side of the tracks, emptying fist-sized chunks of gravel from a rail car onto the ground to be a base for the tracks. Two other cars contained large wooden ties, which Van Horn said were being cut a few miles over and brought to the building site by wagons and iron rails. Up ahead of these men were even more men, cutting down trees, blasting boulders and rocks into fist-sized pieces, and generally transforming a heavily wooded area into a flat road upon which the men behind would lay the tracks.
We can make between 3 and 5 miles a day, weather permitting, if the terrain isn't too hilly and we don't have to cross too many rivers.
Damn, I'll bet Wilson and his men don't do much more than that.
You're correct, Burley. In fact, we usually manage to stay just a few miles behind him.
That's amazing.
Well, of course, he's doing the really hard work of finding a suitable path for the tracks, and sometimes he'll have to backtrack for miles if he comes to an area that cannot be tunneled through or swung around. And I've got the benefit of thousands of men, each doing one particular job, so we can move very fast indeed.
After an evening of fine conversation with Van Horn, wherein he told him of some of his exploits building other railroads in the past, and an even finer dinner, the boys were treated to steaming hot baths. And finally, exhausted, they went to sleep in the sleeping car. They awoke the next morning to a sumptuous breakfast of eggs, bacon, thinly sliced fried steak, flapjacks, and, with Smoke wondering where in the world Van Horn got it at this time of year, freshly squeezed orange juice. As he finished his third cup of coffee, topped off with a cigarette, Smoke thanked Van Horn for being such a gracious host, and then he and his men prepared to leave. Van Horn escorted them out to their horses and showed him how Wilson was marking the trail he was leaving for Van Horn's track layers to follow.
See how he not only blazes the trees to either side of the trail? He also has several rolls of bright red cloth that he ties up high in trees on either side, so the trail will be easy to find.
Thanks, Bill. We shouldn't have too much trouble locating him.
Just be sure to give him a signal when you get close. Tom's been out here in the wilderness many times, and he's been known to shoot first and ask questions later if he feels his men are being threatened.
Will do.